when I was in training, I was watching the autopsy of an 8-year-old girl who'd been smothered and strangled over a $50 bag of cocaine. Horrible case. And I asked the forensic pathologist, I said, how do you do this every day? How do you see this tragedy and still go home and go on? She said, Barbara, what you have to do every single day, when you leave here, you surround yourself with things of beauty, art, nature, music, love, food, everything that's beautiful in the world, because only beauty will counteract the horror, the death, despair, and destruction that you will experience every day.
I'm Steve Murphy, DEA Special Agent retired and now host of the Game of Crimes podcast. If you've seen the Netflix series Narcos, then you know my story. I now bring you stories of heroism and bravery from our law enforcement and military heroes, and occasionally from the criminals that they faced. Welcome to Game of Crimes. You folks came back again today. Thank goodness, because, man, this is one of the best interviews. I shouldn't say that because all the interviews we do here on Game of Crimes, but this one is so different. I'm truly enjoying this. I'm learning a ton. Not that it's going to help me now that I've been retired for a number of years, but it's answering a lot of questions. Our guest again today is Barbara Butcher, who has her book out, What the Dead Know. At the end of this interview today, I will show you where you can get the books, Amazon, like everybody else, but we're going to talk about some other things. She was a death investigator for the medical examiner's office in New York, amongst many other occupations that she's had throughout her life, including being a forensic scientist. So as we left it yesterday, Barbara was telling us about a triple homicide involving the death of a mother and father and their small child because their son was involved with a narcotics gang. And it's just heartbreaking when things like that happen. But then we started talking a little bit about 9/11, but I wanted to wait so we could get into this in a little bit more detail. Now, so we all remember 9/11, 2001, when that was funny. I'm sorry, there was a noise in the background. It was funny, so that's why I'm smiling.
Something just fell off a shelf, and to me, it's like a gunshot. You know, I immediately go into position.
A little bit of PTSD coming there, is
it? Just a touch there, yeah.
And if you haven't listened to yesterday's episode, go back and listen to it, and you'll understand why we just said what we just said there. But so when 9/11 happened, it shocked the world, but especially us here in the United States. And Ground Zero, I was in Washington at the time when the plane hit the Pentagon. I was out a little bit outside of D.C. at that point. They put us on guard duty, Barbara, at the office. It was an offsite classified location where we were with DEA. But across the street was the fuel farm for National Airport. And we're all thinking, if a plane hits there, we're just vaporizers. You know, you wouldn't find anything of us.
That's right.
Maybe we'd rain down on you. I don't know. But what I did see from that was that it galvanized our country back to our, it brought our patriotism back. We just had a former FBI agent who was in New York City when all that happened. And he talked about riding to work every day because he had to be in a police car to get into the city, and how people were out there clapping as you went by, and they were bringing coffee and donuts and they're waving flags. And I know in DC, I was driving in from Northern Virginia into the DC area, and every bridge you went under, there was an American flag taped to that. Everybody had little American flags taped to the antennas of their cars. That's back when we still had antennas on the cars. So in New York, this isn't like a triple homicide. How many victims? I mean, you didn't know it at the time, but eventually, how many victims were there from the two planes hitting the building and all the death and destruction?
You know, I keep forgetting the number because occasionally the number will grow. And I think it's something like 2,754. I don't know what the latest number is. 2,759. I don't know. Let's just say a lot of people. Let's say, I remember the mayor asked my boss, Dr. Charles Hirsch, the chief medical examiner. He said, how many deaths do you think we got here? And he said, more than we can bear. And with thousands of people died. And it's just, it's another one of those overwhelming moments when you realize That statistic, thousands of people dead, it hits you and it has a certain effect. But what I always think of is each and every one of those people was a universe unto themselves. Every one of those people had a family, children, mothers, lovers. They had a family. And that spreads out all across the world, that tragedy. Anyway, I'm getting philosophical.
And I just looked up, the number now is 2,977. So almost 3,000 victims from that day, from one event.
Yeah.
And now your office, what position did you hold at that time? Were you still an investigator?
Yeah, I was a senior investigator at the time. I was not there when it happened because of a weird God shot, another weird God shot. I had had some surgery before, and I was due to go back to work on September 10th. And I was out of sick time. I'd been out for 6 weeks. I called my boss and I said, David, I just can't come in. I don't know what's going on. I don't feel well enough. He said, damn it, you can't do that to me. I've got you on the schedule, the 8 to 4. I've got you doing, you know, scene work. You can't do that. I have nobody. I said, David, I'm sorry. I just can't do it. He said, no, don't be a baby. Come on. I said, David, please. He said, damn it. All right. Come in Wednesday, the 12th. So I wasn't there.
Wow. What emotions did that evoke when it happened?
I was watching the TV and I was horrified, overwhelmed, like screaming, absolutely screaming when I saw the buildings coming down. And you know what feeling I had? Guilt. Guilt that I wasn't there with my colleagues, with the guys, with the people. I wasn't in my own city. I was down in New Jersey in Asbury Park. And I remember I called the Asbury Park Police Department. I said, have you got anybody going in? Yeah, I got to get in. They said, yeah, we just sent a bus out. We're sending another one in about an hour and a half. You give a seat on it. And then they called me back and said, no, we were turned away. No one can get in or out of the city. My God, that feeling. I need to be there. And especially when I heard that Dr. Hirsch had been caught in the collapse and was severely injured. And my friend Diane, another investigator, severely injured. Some of the people from, everybody got hurt. No one died from my office, but badly hurt. Yeah.
Yeah. How long before you finally got back into the city so you could go down there?
Must have been, 18 to 20 hours later. I said the hell with it. The bridges and tunnels were still closed, but I drove in to the Holland Tunnel, and I got up to the barricade, cars coming at me, police cars, and I said, hey, here's my shield. I'm with the medical examiner's office. I've got to get in there, please. And they, of course, searched my car upside down and inside out and underneath, and then I had an escort into the city, and my God, it was so overwhelming. My city filled with smoke and ash. People just running. The sound of sirens. Unbelievable.
You discuss this in your book, but one thing I remember from the time is that all the hospitals in the area immediately set up for mass bodies coming in because they'd heard about it, but nobody showed up.
That's right. Every emergency room, they've got all their staff in. They're putting stretchers out in the streets, you know, opening roads, blocking roads to get people in there. But there were two things that happened at World Trade Center. Either you died or you were sustained injuries that were not really life-threatening. That was it. So nobody came. And, you know, even here's the weird thing. Down at the site, the first responders knew that the hospitals in the city would be absolutely overwhelmed. And so they threw them on ferries and boats to New Jersey. That's where Dr. Hirsch was taken. That's where Diane was taken. Because they knew the hospitals couldn't possibly accept the thousands of people, tens of thousands, who were dead. So, yeah.
Man.
A strange sight. Very strange sight.
How? You got, what, seven investigators? How in the world are you going to deal with a mass casualty event like this?
Working all day and working all night. You know, we just, I think at first everybody just said, I'm staying. You know, we slept on the floors. We slept on, I had a little folding cot in my office. And, no, I didn't have an office at the time. That's right. I just had a folding cot, an army cot. Somebody brought a bunch of them in. And we just kept working. And then we went to 16-hour shifts. Eventually, it went to 12 after a couple of months. But, yeah, everybody just worked. We just were out on the street. We put up a tent outside the back bay entrance of the medical examiner's office. And ambulances and trucks just kept bringing in bodies, just bringing them in. With injuries, I mean, there were hardly any bodies, let's face it. I think out of the nearly 3,000 people that died, there was about 200 more or less whole bodies. People were vaporized.
Yeah. So how do you go about, I mean, I know you have to, we've all heard about the rubble and the pile. We've seen the picture of President Bush standing up there and with the first responders. But when you start going through that pile, there's, you don't know how many bodies, but you know there's a ton of bodies in there. People are wanting to know, where's my son? Where's my daughter, wife, husband, whatever it is? How do you go about identifying anything when it's all piled together like that?
That's right. One bit at a time. You know, my boss, I told him I was overwhelmed with the number of cases I had, a bunch of homicides. And he said, Barbara, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. And this was the biggest elephant ever, like an acre of huge mound of rubble that was two of the tallest buildings in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, standing on that pile and the smoke and the flames and the dust, and not only were there scraps of human flesh and pieces, body parts everywhere, but we knew there were people alive under there. And so police and firefighters are just digging, doing anything they would. Constructors and workers start coming in, lifting the steel beams, that everything, and just trying to get to people who were still alive. And after 1 week, it was no longer a rescue operation. It was a recovery operation. So the mayor, Giuliani at the time, he told a fire department, police department, stand down. There are no more living people in there. Do you think they listened? Oh, sure. They gave it, you know, lip service, but no, people kept pushing. So now we were down there, the medical legal death investigators were down there recovering, you know, the police fire are bringing us body parts. We have to set up tents. We have to, you know, preserve them, take them, label them. And, you know, people, my friends even asked me, why, as a death investigator, were you there? Since you already knew, we knew what killed them. We knew how they died, when they died, who did it, everything about it. What we didn't know was who they were. People were so decimated, so broken, so vaporized that we didn't even know how many of them were dead. It was nearly 3,000 deaths, there were more than 22,000 body parts.
Wow.
So, and you know, only 60% of those bodies or those remains have ever been identified. 40% still unidentified. Maybe they were vaporized. I don't know. Nobody knows. But Dr. Hirsch said one thing. We will do whatever it takes for as long as it takes until we identify and recover every single one of those victims. So it's nearly 25 years now.
Wow.
And we're still doing it.
And I understand Dr. Hirsch has already passed away, but man, what a leader. That's leadership, the information he's given you folks.
That's right.
I'm not telling you anything you don't know.
As injured as he was, he had all his ribs were broken, all of them. But he never told us that. He had a gash of about 14 inches on his arm, and the legend was that he ran into the ER and sewed it up himself. That's not true. He let them sew it up for him. Everybody thought, well, he came back to the office. He's spitting blood, but he came back to the office, and he worked.
Dedication. And you know what? When the head does that, that just, oh, man, that energizes the workers.
Yeah.
If he can do it, I can do it. Look at him. Wow. It's hard to find people like that, that you, I don't say that I have heroes, but man, I probably put that man on a pedestal.
I'm sure you did. He was my hero for sure. Absolutely. For sure. That was a hell of a thing.
Now, so you guys had to set up special buildings and everything around there. I mean, the amount of material, I don't mean to call people material, but I can't think of a better word right now. And then other agencies were volunteering to send in death investigators or forensic scientists, or other people were kicking in as well, right?
Yeah. It was amazing. It was a nationwide response. Like you said, we all had flags on our cars. Everybody's out there cheering us. Everyone in the country is calling to help, to volunteer. I manned the phones for a shift, and guy says, hi, I'll do anything you want. I'll come in. And I said, all right, just give me your number. We'll hold on to that name. But another guy might call and say, hey, I work the Oklahoma City bombing. I'm a funeral director. I'm with the such and such organization. I said, yeah, come on in. And we had people from everywhere. Now, at first, what we did is at the back bay entrance, we put a long tent out into the street, and we set up all kinds of, gurneys, even put 2x4s, sawhorses up, throw a platform on them. And then the trucks would just unload, the ambulances would unload body parts. And we called it working the line. I'd work that line in the middle, and I opened a plastic bag, and in it, I'd find anything, an arm, a finger, scrap of flesh, a bone. And I would take it out, just brush away the dirt carefully, and package it, give it a number, label it, so we could keep track of these remains. One time I opened a bag, and in it was a human heart, a set of car keys, and a penis. Now, what the hell? What is that? The essence of a man? I mean, I can't understand.
But wow.
Cops and firemen were grabbing everything they had. They'd mixing parts, doing everything, just throwing them in the bags and bringing them in. And it was surreal. It was things you'd never see in a lifetime. I hope you don't. And I will never see again. I hope I don't. It was absolutely astounding. And then we'd move them down, and they'd get into the bay area, the garage. And there were autopsy tables set up on 2x4s, stretchers, anything we could get. And the medical examiners, the forensic pathologists, would start gathering things. There would be a guy to collect DNA, somebody to do fingerprints. They'd go to x-ray. We had all these stations, and police were there. FBI was there. National Guard was out there protecting us. They all had these big rifles and those jet planes flying overhead. It was like the adrenaline was insane. I could have worked 48 hours straight. It was like electrifying. And we just kept moving them through, doing the best we could to preserve anything we could to identify a human body.
Wow. And you folks aren't going home either. You're staying there, right?
No, we stayed. We had cots. We had eventually we got tents. And then in the long run, you know, DMORT came in. That's the National Death Management. It's in every state and every region has a DMORT team. And they'll come in and they'll work with you. And DMORT showed up. And my God, that was a lifesaver, because they knew how to run a mass fatality event, mass casualty, but more than that, a mass fatality event. And we got people coming in from all kinds of computer companies, you know, setting up software for us to, you know, put in a number. This is the number of the person, the body part that we found. And here's what it looks like. It's a piece of bone. Oh, but there's a ring on it, and it says 1971, forever, a wedding ring. valuable information, because now we're also taking reports from the victims' families. We have a victim assistance center in the a family assistance center where they all come into the armory and the families tell us everything they can about the guy or the woman. Manicure or no manicure, rings, earrings, earlobes long or short, blue eyes, brown eyes, tell us everything you can, and then hopefully feed it all into these software systems and see if we can get a match. My God, it's been going on for 25 years. And DNA, of course, proved to be, you know, fundamental to that process, especially as it advanced. The technology changed rapidly. We had to do whatever we could to get the least little amount of DNA could possibly yield an identification. Oh, and forensic dentistry, odontology, getting, you know, x-rays, the jaw, the dentist, we had like 40 dentists there volunteering, like listing each filling, each crown, each veneer. And then people would bring us the dental records from their loved ones. I mean, this was crazy. So we're all out in these trailers and tents and trucks, and we're all sleeping out there and living there and working there. And Salvation Army came in and set up Sal's Cafe. The big tent, they had sweatshirts, dry socks, and food. Lots and lots of food and lots of coffee. And that's where we would refresh ourselves. I didn't want to go home. Why would I want to go home? I needed, with every fiber of my being, I needed to be there. Not just because I had a job to do, but because I needed my colleagues. I needed them to see the same things I was seeing. I couldn't go home and say, hey, honey, you know what I saw today? The damnedest thing. A jawbone inside a man's chest. A different man. Two different people. Imagine that. You can't say that stuff when the kids are around. Can't say it any time. Civilians don't need to know those horrors. So when you're with your buddies, yeah, you can even laugh a little bit. Dark humor, you know?
Defense mechanism. Man, I can't imagine. I'm glad you mentioned that about the Salvation Army, because I read that in your book, Sal's Kitchen. Plus you needed that support from each other. Because you're seeing things, like we said yesterday, you're seeing things that no human being is ever meant to see.
Yeah, ever, ever. And you're seeing it over and over again, and you're seeing variations on it, and you're seeing things you just could never have imagined that could happen. Just amazing.
Well, you mentioned that it was things that you'd never see again, but you actually did, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
based on what you folks were able to accomplish there at Ground Zero, 9/11, New York City, it became a learning ground or a standard for other mass fatality situations?
I became an expert in mass fatality management by default. This was the biggest one in decades, let's say. So I worked Flight 587, 256 people killed, something like that. You know, multiple bodies burned. Worked on that one right after 9/11. And, you know, of course, we suspected it was terrorism. Then anthrax cap happened, right? And we're set up for anthrax. We're set up for plane crashes. And so I wound up going to the London Underground bombing to share our knowledge with them when they had the subways and buses bombed. I went to Thailand after the tsunami that killed 250,000 people. A tsunami at Christmas time. So I went there with Dr. Hirsch and another colleague, and we helped them. We had our DNA scientists come over there and help them. And we had, you know, we worked together with all different nations, Europe and Asia, and put together a way to do it. Now, let me tell you about horrifying. When you're in they use the temples as body collection points, because at least that way the monks could bless them on their way out, right? We dug trenches to put the bodies in. But the Europeans said, no, we want our bodies back. We want you to identify our citizens, the tourists, and send them back to us. And we helped them do that. Now, the Thai people, you know, unmarked graves for the most part. But I learned so much for those from the Thai people. I don't know if it's, I guess it's Buddhism. It's about acceptance. Acceptance of the facts as they are right in front of you, whether you hate it or not, it's there. What is your attitude going to be? Are you going to fall into a heap of grief, wailing and crying? Are you going to go into a fugue state? Or are you going to get up and do something for life? And they did. They had trucks going through Bangkok with an announcement, work, work for everyone. And they were paying them. And people came from all over. And so their homes were destroyed, but they lived in tents while they helped collect the bodies, while they helped rebuild their economy. It's just amazing. I love those people. Very, very brave people.
That's what I said yesterday and again today. I mean, you have seen things that some of the most hardened military and first responders have seen similar, but not to the amount. Mm-hmm. The quantity. Oh, man, it's 250,000 casualties. Just, it's almost hard to believe, isn't it?
It is. 250,000 people dead inside of a couple hours. 30-foot surge of ocean water coming in. Something, isn't it? So strange, strange things.
Yeah. Gosh.
But you know what? We get up and we do our job. We get up and we help those families. We help get justice for those victims. We help return people to their families so they have something to bury, something to mourn, because there's nothing worse than not knowing.
Right. Outside of 9/11, what is one investigation that maybe you're most proud of that you were able to bring resolution to? Is there one that sticks out in your mind?
The truth is, all of them. I am very proud of every single one of my cases. Now, you ask some investigators, they'll tell you about a time a movie star, you know, Heath Ledger, the big-time star pop singer who dies, and they did a very thorough investigation. Guess what? I did a very thorough investigation on each and every one. That person, I don't care if it's a junkie, just got out of jail and died on the streets. I don't care if it's a movie star or the, you know, big Hollywood thing. I don't care. I look at that victim, that person, as my patient in that moment. I am working for their family. I'm working to get justice, working to get closure for that family, get answers for them. And that person, each one of them deserves a federal investigation. In fact, you know, I was testifying recently in court. A case I did more than 30 years ago finally came to trial.
Wow.
A guy killed a mother and a daughter, and it was horrible. And I thought it was the boyfriend of the home health aide, but we couldn't prove it. Well, 31 years later, we did. Going back and retesting that DNA, rerunning it in the data bank in CODIS. I testified at that trial. And then the defense attorney says to me, "No, Ms. Butcher, this case was particularly important, wasn't it?" And I said, "Yes, all of them are very important." He said, no, but this one in particular was very important. It was very unusual, wasn't it?" "No, sir. Again, all of them are important. All of them are unusual. All of them are absolutely deserving my full attention." And he's like, "Okay." You know, I mean, I don't know what he was trying to prove, but come on. Everybody is somebody. Everybody has a mother and a daughter. They were babies. They were husbands, lovers, brothers, sisters, everything.
Well, you describe very well in your book about the first time you testified and getting rattled and how to deal with that. And apparently Dr. Hirsch worked with you on that, but,
yeah.
And then you became able to, well, just tell us about that if you don't mind.
Well, you know, a defense attorney will do everything he can to rattle you and to diminish you in the eyes of the jury, right?
Yeah.
I remember this guy, defense attorney, said, Miss Butcher, you're not even a doctor, are you? No, I'm not. I'm a death investigator. Well, Miss Butcher, are you an expert on stab wounds? Have you ever written a book about them? No. Have you ever written an article about them? No. But I've seen about 500 stab deaths. So. And then, but he rattled me. He made me angry. And that makes you lose concentration, makes you lose credibility. Dr. Hirsch taught me, when either attorney, prosecutor or defense, asks you a question, you pause. You listen politely. You pause for a couple of seconds. He said 10, but I can't do more than 5. And then you turn to the jury and you address them. Each and every individual, you look at them and you teach them what you see. You tell them what you saw and you teach them what it means. Boy, I got that same defense attorney in there, and this time I aced it. When he said, isn't it possible that the smoke on the wall, that blank spot where you say the victim was sitting, couldn't that be from the fire hoses putting it out? Turned to the jury. Well, any of you who've tried to clean an oven or a wood-burning stove know that you can't clean it with water. It takes a strong detergent like lye. They're like, yeah, it does.
And that's when you see a juror nod at you, you know. Ooh, you got
them. That's heaven. That's heaven. Yep. They are the triers of fact. They deserve the answers, not the defense attorney.
Exactly. Or the prosecutor. That's why you turn to the jury. That's the people you have to convince.
Yep.
Good lessons for you rookies out there. And you must be reading my mind, because I just highlighted in my notes here to ask you about testifying in court.
I loved it.
What would you consider the best part and the worst part of your job?
The best part was also the worst part, and that is that I get to see things that no one else has ever seen, and I get to do something about it. So, as many tragedies, as many horrors that filled my brain, I got to see what life and death are really like. And I got to work with some of the best people in the world. Law enforcement, firemen, DAs that get justice for us every day. That see things that we see things that you can't. Not you, but the average person. You can't see that stuff. We're going to do it. We're strong. We can do it. Unfortunately, a lot of us went a little too far. I remember Dr. Hirsch said to me, I said, God, you know, we got to get counseling. Chief, the guys are, you know, they're working this 9/11 thing, and they're drinking, they're upset, they're out of their minds. And he said, no, Barbara, we are very, very strong people. We can do it, and therefore we do it. Now, that's the only time in his life that I've ever known him to be wrong, but he's one of those guys. Nope, you do it. You suck it up. So, so the best thing was doing the job, and the worst thing was doing the job, because it crushed my soul. I couldn't sustain relationships anymore. Once you detach fully, it's hard to reattach, to open up and be vulnerable, which you need to do to have relationships with people. So.
And you said that, I think in the book, or you may have said it, but there's discussion about you don't want, when Dr. Hirsch said it, I think you guys might have been at dinner, that you don't want to be identified by your job, but that's what takes over.
Yeah. Dr. Hirsch said, you're not what you do. You are who you are. You're a human being, not a human doing. And they say that in 12-step programs too. But I didn't hear it. I became my job. If anyone met me at a party and said, tell me about yourself, I say, oh, I'm the chief of staff at the New York City Medical Examiner's office, and I'm responsible for investigating the deaths, blah, 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 blah. They'd be like, oh, okay. Tell us a story. No, I don't want to tell you a damn story, okay? What's the worst thing you've ever seen? I don't know, but that's the worst question I ever heard.
Yeah.
I became that identity. And then, after 23 years, I was now chief of staff I was responsible for overall management of the agency, and Dr. Hirsch was in charge of the medical aspect of the agency. I lived that job. I breathed it. I dressed for it. I thought like it. I talked like it. And then when I was forced to retire from politics, a new mayor came in. And that new mayor is allowed to remove all the agency heads, all the top people. And he did. And I fell apart. I had a major nervous breakdown, as they call them. I was so sick. I was suicidal. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know how I felt. I had nothing to define me. But without giving everything away,
right,
I'm going to tell you that here I am, all these years later. And I turned that pain into a book. I got work as a private consultant working with a forensic pathologist. We did private cases where the family didn't agree with the verdict they got or the, looking into what really happened. So I had a very lucrative practice, consulting practice. And then COVID came and everything fell apart. There were no more juries anymore. Nobody was doing trials. So I had hardly any work. And I decided people have been telling me for years I should write a book. So I did. And a good friend of mine, a mystery writer, a suspense writer named Kate White, she had a little dinner party, invited some agents and some publicity people there. And she said, "Barbara, tell them about your work." And I did. She got me a literary agent, just like that. Isn't that something? See, that's the power of women who are high up on the platform and they lift up others with them. That's Kate White. That's Patricia Cornwell, who helped me so much. She became a good friend. And, you know, she donated a lot of money to our Forensic Science Academy that I had created some years before with a grant from the NIH. We were teaching investigators from all over the country. So these good people took me up there with them. So I wrote the book. And the first draft, I gave it to my editor. He read it, and I went and met with him. And he said, "Barbara, these stories are fascinating, but where are you?" I said, "Well, I'm right here." He said, "No, where are you in the book? I want to see what you see. I want to smell it, hear it, feel it, taste it. I want to be seeing what you see, and I want to feel what you feel." I said, "Oh, geez, you want me to cry, don't you?" He said, "Yeah, go ahead. I want you to put it in there." So I did. I went back there and I put myself in there. And yes, I cried a lot. Reliving those experiences, whoa. And I was angry and upset, anxious. But I did it. And I think it came out to be, I know it came out to be one hell of a good book.
It did.
It's a memoir of a life of someone who's in death.
Seems very ironic, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? Yeah, it is. What the dead know. I learned so much from them.
Well, I'm not going to tell you what happened, but I do have to mention the last chapter of the book is titled "They Locked My Ass Up." Mm-hmm. So you got to find out what happened there, but it resulted in who we're talking to today. I mean, thinking back of all the things that she's told us about, she spent 22, 23 years doing this. And then after leaving that job, you don't call it retirement when the new mayor comes in, but whatever that term is, you've continued to do that, which you're still helping your fellow man, which, you know, you're a public servant. But you know, a lot of people think that term public servant is a derogatory term. I look at it as a badge of honor because you chose your life. You gave your life to serve your fellow man.
That's right.
No higher calling in my book. But you got involved in a little bit of an extracurricular activity in the stage and theater, right?
Oh, yeah. You know, I was talking to my psychiatrist and I said, "I don't feel relevant anymore. I'm not helping anybody. What am I doing? I don't feel like I'm a part of anything." And he said, "When you were a kid, was there a career you wanted to have that you couldn't because it was impractical and, you know, you needed to feed yourself and pay the rent?" I said, "Yeah, I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be an actor." And he said, why don't you take acting lessons? He said, your pension will pay the bills. Go ahead and do something different. Do something fun. So I did. I went down to HB Studios in Manhattan, and I studied under a couple of great acting teachers, and Vinnie Pastore. Vinnie is from The Sopranos. My acting teacher, my coach. Great guy. Absolutely great guy. And we had so much fun. And it brought me out of myself. It gave me a new crowd to hang out with, creative people. It gave me a new outlook on life, you know, fantasy and art and creativity. And so after I wrote the book, actually not even relevant to the book, but Dick Wolf did a show on Netflix called Homicide New York. And it's about big cases in the city. And he had all the detectives that worked those cases, including guys like, Rob Mooney. And one of them said to the producer, you should bring Barbara Butcher in here because she worked this case with me. And they asked me to come in and do the show. I did, I think there were 5 episodes. I did 3 of them. And they didn't pay anything. Because it's a documentary, they can't pay you. They give you $500 for your expenses, 3 days' work. And I said, yeah, what the hell? It's fun. And I did it. And it was great. It was amazing. I just got to get up and be me into a camera. And it worked out really well. So Dick Wolf saw that show and said, yeah, she's pretty good. She's interesting. Get her something of her own. And they did. They said, would you like to do an unscripted show about the cases you've investigated and teach us and show us what happened? And we'll go back to the scenes. I said, hell yeah. So that Netflix show, unpaid, brought me a show that actually paid me. So now I have on Peacock and Oxygen a show called The Death Investigator with Barbara Butcher. And that show has been so interesting. Probably the best part of it is getting back with the detectives and the cops that I worked with originally, because we share that feeling. We go back to that scene and you can feel it all coming up again. You can feel it. And I want to tell people, of course, cops are human, but they're superhuman in so many ways. A detective who devotes his life to pursuing justice for someone he doesn't even know. These guys get so involved. You know this from your work. You get so into it. You care so much that it's even damaging. And just like me, your soul gets damaged, but you do it because you believe in the mission. So seeing those guys again, it warms me. And going back to those scenes, it brings it all back. Why was it? How did it happen? Why did it happen? What does it mean? I get to answer those questions now. So, so the show has been remarkable. And now I'm doing a podcast. We're start production next week. So,
excellent.
Yeah. So it's brought me a whole new life. I mean, look, I go from being a miserable little drunk to working in surgery, to working in hospitals, to working in the best career you could ever imagine. And then, at my advanced age, to have a whole new chapter in your life. And I'm here to tell you all, there is no such thing as a final chapter until you're dead. You can keep rewriting, reinventing your life. Damn, I even fell in love recently. Isn't that something?
There you go.
It's fantastic.
Yep.
You know, for women who say, oh, I'll never meet anybody else. Yeah, look at me, honey. I did. Okay. Life is wonderful. Life is about evil and it's about beauty. When I was in training, I was watching the autopsy of an 8-year-old girl who'd been smothered and strangled over a $50 bag of cocaine. And horrible case. And I asked the forensic pathologist, I said, how do you do this every day? How do you see this tragedy and still go home and go on? She said, Barbara, what you have to do every single day, when you leave here, you surround yourself with things of beauty, art, nature, music, love, food, everything that's beautiful in the world, because only beauty will counteract the horror, the death, despair, and destruction that you will experience every day. And at first I said, oh, that's some hippie trippy bullshit. I don't need that. Eventually, I found out she was right. I got myself a little fixer-upper house in the country, a dog, two cats, some trees. I actually hugged my trees. I love my trees. Big old sycamore. Oh, I love that tree. And it cleansed my soul. It really did. And I am a lucky, lucky person.
That was, I remember in the book you talked about that person telling you, try to find something beautiful in whatever you're doing. And you're going out to death scenes and you're investigating a homicide as the sun's coming up over the river or over the bridge or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
That's good advice. You can be in the worst situation that you can think of, but you could probably still find something of beauty if you look.
Mm-hmm.
Most people wouldn't.
Yeah, that Central Park murder, 2 15-year-olds brutally butchered a man. And I'm out there and the sun is rising over the Central Park lake. Everything is bathed in pastels. I suddenly became aware of myself. I'm in a movie scene here. Mutilated body, a sunrise, a park. Mind blowing.
No wonder Dick Wolf wanted you having your own show. And just tell everybody who Dick Wolf is. There's one series everybody will know.
Yes, Law & Order. Law & Order and Law & Order Special Victims Unit, SVU, with Mariska Hargitay, a fabulous person, by the way, who always helps others, has a foundation to help rape victims. I mean, he's got the longest running shows in television history, 25 years of a show, you know? Remarkable guy, and I am so proud to be working with him.
Excellent. I mean, it's just, I term it that life's an adventure. You know, you never know what door is going to open. Don't be afraid to step through the door.
That's
see
right.
What's out there.
Things get better.
Whoever thought this redneck hillbilly would be running a podcast for 5 years now?
I know. Whoever thought you would have busted up drug rings and saved lives and getting narcotics out of here and getting justice for people? My brother John died of a heroin overdose.
Oh,
there's no justice. No. He died at 24 years old. There's no justice for that. But, you know, you helped prevent those things.
Well, I like to think I did. But, you know, you don't – it's a team effort. It's not an individual thing. There's no one person going out there doing it all. So we're getting close to the end here, and Barbara's running short on time. She's been so gracious to give me her time today and to tell us things that you may have never wanted to hear, but you need to hear. But – Looking back on everything, Barbara, from childhood to today, if you had it all to do over again, is there anything that you would change?
Yeah, I wouldn't worry so much. I spent so much time in my life, we all do, worrying about things that we have no control over, and they never happen, or sometimes they do. But my worrying, did it help? No, it just made me upset. Don't worry. Don't worry.
Not at all what I was expecting to hear, but that's very, very important and true.
I'd do it all again.
One last thing. You've kind of already done this already, but any words of wisdom or advice that you'd like to leave people with, regardless of their occupation, but especially if they're considering a high risk occupation like a first responder, death investigator, military, that kind of thing?
Take care of yourself first. You know, on the plane when they announce that to lose cabin pressure, put on your own oxygen mask before you try to help others. Yeah, that's it. You can't help others if you don't take care of yourself. Please get therapy. Do things. Surround yourself with things of beauty. All of you out there, firemen, ER personnel, cops, death investigators, MEs, please take care of your heart, and then you're better for everybody else. And with that, I say stay safe. God bless you all.
Well, I'm not letting you go just yet. I got to ask you a couple more questions. What is the name of this podcast you're getting ready to start?
I don't know.
Oh, that's a funny name. I don't know.
I know. It's a great question. It's a great title, isn't it? If you go to my website, just put Barbara Butcher Official in Google and you'll come up my website and announces everything. See, interviews and articles, books, TV shows, it's all there.
And ladies and gentlemen, you're seeing a placard up on the screen now that shows you where you can find Barbara on all her social media sites. Her book is What the Dead Know, came out in 2023. You can find it at Barnes & Noble, Amazon. There's a whole list on her website where you can find her book. And her company name, I got to mention this, Barbara. What's your middle initial?
F.
No, what's your real middle initial?
A, Barbara Ann Butcher. But and my company is Barbara F. Butcher Associates. And that stands for Barbara fucking Butcher.
I love it. I love it. Fantastic. That's, you know what, man? Just, ladies and gentlemen, don't let your circumstances get you down and dictate what your future is going to be. You can always recover. You can always get back up. You just never give up. You just heard one of the best stories of perseverance and redemption and just taking it on the chin and getting back up and continuing to fight that I've ever heard. It's been truly, and I said this yesterday, a true honor, Barbara, to have you here on the Game of Crimes. Thank you so much for your openness, for your transparency. Can't wait to see what else you're going to do in the future. And let me tell you, you got a fan here. I will start keeping up with you everywhere you go. So thank you for being on Game of Crimes.
Thank you, Murph.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I got to go try to calm down after this one because my wife's got honeydews here for me to do. But thank you, folks, for continuing to come back every single week. If you noticed recently, we did not have a video on YouTube for 1 week. That was one of our individuals that runs an anti-human trafficking organization. That was at his request. Okay. And there's some underlying factors there that you don't need to know, but you can still hear it on audio. And that leads me to my final statement here. Why do you continue to come back? And that's because you enjoy playing the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all. And that's our Game of Crimes. God bless everybody. Stay safe. See you next week.